All right, welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Preston Connor. I'll be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. This year, 2015, marks the 50th anniversary of the Hinckley Institute. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to engaging students in government and the community and fostering a deeper understanding in the policies and the issues of the day. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 55 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $700,000 in scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forums is Restricted Rights, Militarization of Contemporary Policing, is co-sponsored by the Office for Equity and Diversity as part of the Martin Luther King Jr. celebration. I'd now like to turn the time over to our moderator, Dr. William A. Smith, Associate Professor of the Department of Education.
Good afternoon. Well, I'm proud to be able to host this or moderate this special talent of panelists that we have, and I won't take long. We have about 54 minutes for the radio broadcast, but after the broadcast, I invite you to stick around and ask more questions. I'm sure they'll have many more answers to provide us. I'd like to introduce, in order of presentation, our panelists, Meg Day, who was selected as the best new poet of 2013, is a 2013 recipient of the NEA Fellowship in Poetry and the author of Last Psalm at Sea Level. She was the winner of the 2013 Beryl Street First Book Prize in Poetry. We also have Dr. Emily Chang, who's an associate professor in the Quigley School of Law at the University of Utah. She received her JD from Harvard Law School. We also have Dr. Malcolm Holmes, professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Wyoming. His primary research interests involve the relationship of race and ethnicity to criminal justice decision-making. And last but certainly not least, Dr. Roderick Land, who is a special assistant to the president at Salt Lake Community College. He changed jobs a couple of times. He's also, as you might know, he's a professor here at the University of Utah and has worked for the county, and now he's at SLIC. So welcome our panelists. So we'll start.
Great. Thank you. Good afternoon. Can you all hear me all right? My name is Meg Day, and I'm a PhD candidate here at the University of Utah in poetry and disability poetics. I'm queer, I'm hard of hearing, and I'm white. When the topic of this panel was changed to militarization of contemporary policing, I had a difficult time imagining what it was that I could contribute. As a masculine of center, queer, and as a nearly deaf person who frequently has a difficult time following directions because I literally cannot hear them, I'm not unfamiliar with the micro and macroaggressions, the harassment, and the physical violence of police officers in every city I've ever lived in, especially in my home of Oakland, California. But as a white person, in constant self, community, and classroom conversation about white privilege, especially with my students, I have to assume that much of the effects of militarization of policing regularly go unnoticed by me. I fear police, but I very rarely, if ever, am the target of their fear. In November of this last year, a young queer black poet in my community named Danesse Smith wrote an open call to white poets everywhere, and I want to extend a portion of that to you today. As a poet, I understand my responsibility as entirely political and as entirely that of witness. In the past, we've seen a lot of anthologies come out. Poetry of Witness, The Tradition of English from 1500 to 2001 comes to mind. But these books rarely include poets of color and almost never include topics of community upset, protest, violence, or healing. They reinforce the idea that poets are unnecessary, that nature and love are the only things within their purview, and that only white poets are the ones worth archiving. I want to extend Dinez Smith's call to action as my own response to the state of militarization of policing today, and I want to extend it as a challenge to stand witness in whatever ways you can, and to push that challenge onto the laps of the white folks in your lives. Demand that this not go unnoticed. Poets believe witness and archive is how militarization can be affected by the individual. After speaking about Darren Wilson and Johannes Meserle, Smith writes, "I did not come here to talk about these men. I came to you, my partners in verse who build a life's work documenting their brief time on this earth. I come asking you to question the landscape of our pastoral muse. I ask you to question what makes you safe. What frees you to write odes of the low country of America, to mention the trees and not their wicked history, to write the praise song of night but not sing of what dark bodies hide in cold daylight. My family, and I pray we can call one another family, I am asking you to do what you do best, to write. We must be members of the new guards for those whose futures have been deemed questionable and expendable. I'm asking you to explode the canon with what we must make sure is remembered in this nation. We cannot leave the duty of elegy for black bodies and calls for our fellow citizens to rise, even if wounded or enraged or scared, especially scared, to the catalogs of solely black artists. We must write the American lyric like Claudia Rankine so fearlessly writes, no matter how brutal or reflective it might be for you. There are people I cannot reach because what I make is degraded, and why not glorified, for its label of black art. I implore, I need you to make art, black, dark art that shines an honest light on the histories of your paler skin. I ask you to join those fighting under the cry of Black Lives Matter in whatever way you can. Research ways you can be involved in your local community. Think critically about how you can use your privilege and influence. Affect change. I challenge you to make art that demands the safety of me, of many of your writing siblings, of so many people walking the streets in fear of those who are charged to protect us, even of people who we hesitate at times to call our fellow Americans. And this is not the only fight we must wage. There are many suffering the awful weight of a society and judicial system that is edited for all from with liberty and justice. We must create work that refuses to leave this world the same as when we entered it. We do not have the luxury of only writing the selfish confession. We must testify in our court of craft that these poems we write are bold and unflinching and unwilling to stale idle in a geography of madness. We must demand of ourselves to write the uncomfortable, dangerous, shift-making poems. How much longer will we write casually in the face of a beast? Submit your facts to the candid world. I ask you to join me and others in utilizing verse to not rewrite our shared grisly history. I end this letter not by begging you please, but by telling you you must.
Thank you. Professor Chang.
So I just learned something new. Never agree to follow a poet. That was beautiful, Meg. Thank you.
Dinez Smith.
Well, thank you for sharing it with us. So on a more mundane note, my name is Emily Chang, and my craft is far removed, I think, from that of Meg's for lack of talent and gift, I think. I run a public policy clinic at the law school down the hill, and our focus the last several years has been on trying to stop the school-to-prison pipeline, as it exists in Utah. Just by quick show of hands, how many of you are familiar with the term school-to-prison pipeline? Okay, a few. That's a good number. So, just a quick primer. It's a nationwide phenomenon. It's not limited to Utah, by which students are increasingly funneled towards the criminal justice system instead of the higher education system. And it has a variety of faces that it wears, but it definitely disproportionately affects students of color, students with disabilities, English language learners, essentially our most vulnerable youth. And some of you might be wondering, well, what does this have to do with the militarization of the police, right? I thought we were here to talk about Ferguson, and so far I've heard about poetry, and now we're going to talk about the school-to-prison pipeline. In my defense, I was asked to talk about what militarization of the police means to me, and this is my current obsession, so that's part of it, right? When you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. But to make the link more explicit, I think that the two phenomenon, militarization of the police on the one hand, the school-to-prison pipeline on the other, really have the same underlying issue at heart, right? It's like the same genetic code. And it's this tendency that we have, I think as Americans, I think it's almost a cultural phenomenon. Maybe if there's some sociologists or a cultural anthropologist in the room, you can explore this idea with me. The idea that more is more and that harsher is better, right? That if we want to get something done, what we need to do is do more of it and to do it harder, faster, with more resources, right? And I think it's what's driving the militarization is the idea, well, we want to keep our communities and our streets safe, and so what we need is more policing, and the policing needs to be more aggressive, and the cops need to have more things, right? What they need isn't necessarily, unfortunately, I think, more talk of empathy or more communication, but we tend to think in terms of objects, right? We want more guns, more tools, more power, more ammunition. And it should be more powerful guns. If a small gun is good, then a big gun is better. And I see the same thing happening in the context of our school systems. And I find this particularly distressing because, of course, we're talking about our children. And here the way it plays out is, you know, well, we want to keep our schools safe because we have these young, vulnerable children. And it starts as a small idea of, well, maybe we should have police officers in schools, in part to keep them safe. And then we sort of lose track of why the officers were there in the first place. And we think, well, maybe more cops in schools are better. And you end up with school-based arrests, and you end up with school-based referrals to law enforcement, right? And you decide, well, I want to keep our children safe, and so what we need is metal detectors. We need searches. We want to keep them free from drugs, and so we need more locker searches, more invasive searches. I once litigated a case in Atlanta, Georgia, where the children not only had to walk through a metal detector, they had to open their mouths, stick out their tongues, take off their shoes. Someone rubbed the soles of their feet to make sure there was nothing in their socks. And then the female children wearing bras had to do something called popping their bras. They'd extend their bra straps forward and snap them back in to prove that they had nothing in them. And the idea was, well, if some searching is good, more must be better, right? So you end up with a whole phenomenon in which we're treating children, we're kind of priming them, grooming them for a life in the criminal justice system. You learn to walk more obediently. You learn to respect authority more. And we're doing it with the tools that used to be reserved to the police. And as the civilian police force has become increasingly militarized, so too has the police force that we entrust our children to. We have gang sweeps. We have drug sweeps. Sniffer dogs come through, right? There are mass locker searches. The result of all of this, I think you see it both in the communities being subject to militarized policing and in the schoolchildren communities being affected by militarization in the schools, is alienation, right? Studies have shown that if you're suspended even once in the ninth grade, you're 3.5 times more likely to drop out of school, right? So graduation rates are lower. Kids just check out. They're alienated from the authority figures in their lives. And this is happening in Utah, right, which is really unfortunate. So my clinic actually published a report. It's called From Finger Paint to Fingerprints. If you're interested, I encourage you to Google it. And it lays out what's happening in our very own communities, right? So I know our time is limited. I'm going to spend 1 minute maybe on what you can do about this, because I think that's always important. And it's the fun part for me where I get to ask you to do something. Sometimes I think we sit here and we listen to these depressing facts and we say, wow, that was a real bummer, right? And then we eat our pizza and we go home. But there are ways that you can get involved in these issues. If you're a poet, obviously, I think Meg presents a fabulous option. If you're less artistically minded, figure out what the statistics are in your local community schools. The federal government has a fabulous website. If you Google OCR data, which stands for Office of Civil Rights, it is searchable school by school. whether you have a child in school or you went to a particular high school in the community, I urge you to look it up. And if the results shock you and dismay you, which I think they probably will, given what I've seen in terms of the data statewide, get in touch with someone. Write a letter to your school board. Write a letter to the principal. If you're an alum of a high school and you think the statistics are, you know, horrifying, drop by and say, hey, I graduated from this school a few years ago. I'm a student at the U right now. And, you know, have you thought about why black students or your school are being disciplined 3.5 times more often than white students? Or why the graduation rate for English language learners at your school is only 50%? These are the data, right? Raising awareness, I think, is a fabulous place to start. The legislative session is underway soon. There's going to be a zero tolerance bill on bullying. Again, more is more, right? We don't like bullying, so zero tolerance. That's not always the answer. Testify, literally. Legislative sessions are open to the public. Take a look at the subcommittee hearing schedules and show up, right? Show up, testify. That's my piece.
Thank you. Professor Holmes.
Now we get to Ferguson. My research over the past several years has involved primarily, it's involved police brutality. And certainly militarism in police departments is a significant issue with respect to the question of how police treat citizens. But before we get to that, I'd like to ask, why do we have a military to protect us from our enemies and, if need be, destroy them? And then I would ask, are our citizens our enemies? The answer to that, of course, is no, they are not. Yet we hear about wars on drugs, we hear about wars on crime, and each of these metaphors provides us with an image that somehow there are those among us who are particularly deserving of being destroyed, at least by virtue of being sent to the penitentiary, or if need be, to be subjected to force by the police. Now, what is a military model of policing? I would suggest to you that it goes back in history for at least the past century. The emergence of professional policing in the United States started taking shape in the early 20th century, and by the 1950s we had this image, as we saw on Dragnet, of these professional police officers, just the facts, ma'am, kind of image of what policing is about. Well, this model of professional policing is complete with a chain of command in which the ranks are designated with terms such as sergeant and lieutenant. Police officers attend training academies that are largely built on a model of the military boot camp. And they become part of a system in which they become isolated and insulated, if you will, from the rest of society. I have to move to the next page of my notes. I get easily off track, so you'll have to excuse me. The question is, of course, how does this affect our citizens when we fight these wars? And when we fight the war on drugs, for example, we know that citizens of color are disproportionately targeted. And it's not that whites are using fewer drugs, or fewer whites are using drugs, I should say, than are citizens of color. In fact, quite the opposite. We know the evidence shows that blacks and Latinos use drugs at a lower rate than do whites. Whites, however, share their drugs through their friendship networks and so on, whereas in urban communities, many African American neighborhoods, disadvantaged neighborhoods, drug use is more public, drug sales are more public, and these are where the war on drugs are fought. And it is the case that, you know, the people in these neighborhoods become, in a sense, enemies. Everybody becomes perceived as a threat to police officers who are out there trying to protect us from these dangerous people who are using drugs. Well, of course, most of these individuals are no more dangerous than are the whites who are in their comfortable suburban homes using drugs with their friends while mom and dad are at work. It is the case that this is a type of stereotype, if you will, that suggests to us that some segments of our society are more dangerous, they're more threatening, hence they need to be destroyed. Michelle Alexander argues in her book, and I had Michelle Williams in my notes, obviously the wrong person. Michelle Alexander argues in her book, The New Jim Crow, that what happens in this drug war course is young African-American men, much as you're talking about, are funneled into the criminal justice system. They're funneled into prison. They come out suffering civil disabilities, such as the inability to vote, and as a result, they cannot participate. They're excluded from the larger society. It's very difficult for them to get jobs. And again, ultimately, one of the best options available to them may wind up sending them back to the penitentiary again. Now, it is the case that Jerome Skolnick and Jim Fife argued a few years ago in their book Above the Law that this kind of policing, this militaristic approach, is what causes police brutality. There's an us versus them mentality that generates from it. There's a blue wall of silence whereby police officers are unwilling to inform on other officers, and that in their day-to-day lives on the streets, they see these young men, young women, most of whom pose no threat whatsoever to anyone, as the enemy. And that is potentially a cause of police brutality. And certainly militarism has increased. In the last 30 years, we've seen an increase in the firepower that police departments employ. It's sort of an arms race as they perceive it, where you have to keep up when this is, again, what you're talking about. More guns are better guns, and bigger ones. Used to be 9mm. Now they're, I don't know what they're using as a standard sidearm, but they're larger calibers for fear that you know, that somebody may be wearing a vest or some such thing. And we've seen it with as we saw in Ferguson in the aftermath of the horrific events there, in the protests, that light armored vehicles are being brought onto the street. These are surplus vehicles bought from the U.S. government. All signs of militarism, certainly conducive to police brutality. But I would suggest to you that there is a more important underlying problem, and that militarism is simply a symptom of it. My colleague Brad Smith, who's at Wayne State University, which is very near where the Detroit Riot of 1967 started, and I have been conducting research for several years, as I said, on police brutality. And recently we published a paper in which we did a national study looking at the incidence of police brutality, or more correctly, excessive force, sustained excessive force complaints in cities of 100,000 plus population. So these are large cities. There's about 225 of them. And what we find is that, first of all, cities with relatively large black and Hispanic populations have a higher incidence of police brutality. More troubling yet is the fact that when you look at the degree of segregation in cities, we find that where there is a very high degree of segregation of black citizens, there's the incidence of police brutality is utterly astronomical. Who are the enemy? The enemy are the poor, the disadvantaged, people who live in segregated neighborhoods. And the solution to the problem, in contrast to what people such as Skolnick and Fife suggest, is not going to be found in programs like community policing, which are immensely popular. It's going to be found in solving the underlying problem. And we've known this ever since the Kerner Commission reported on the civil disorders of the 1960s, that the problems we confront are inequalities in housing, in recreation, in education, in a whole host of other areas. The root problem is not the militarism of the police. It's certainly a problem, and it's certainly one that contributes to phenomena like police brutality. But ultimately, it's inequality. In my lifetime, inequality will persist, perhaps in yours. But as you think about things in your life that you may be able to do to change things for the better, the fight against inequality in America is certainly an important starting point.
Thank you. Dr. Land.
Yes, well, welcome. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Okay. I'll try to keep mine relatively brief so we have more time for questions and answers. I feel like I'm better in answering questions than just actually speaking to people, because I prefer a dialogue as opposed to me just having a monologue, if you will. But I'll slightly augment maybe a few statements that have been made up to this point and take maybe a different approach in terms of thinking about the fundamental issue of this issue of militarization of police. And I would say it's more specific, not so much the inequality, that's the fundamental issue of it, but I would say it's the morality, right? I think that America has a fundamental morality issue, right? And so if you think about how we're talking about these issues, whether it's Ferguson or if we're talking about any other issues that we've seen that's permeated within our United States, it's about our perception of who is moral and who is not moral. So if you think about the things that we'll say with Ferguson, we keep it on that, or even say Saratoga Springs, right? Here local within our own community. It's this idea about this perception that somehow the person who I'm looking at is somehow much more immoral than who I am. And somehow we become the moral judgments, or police become the moral character judges, if you will, of those people who they're actually facing. So the thing becomes is that the irony of all this is that even though they're trying to be these moral judges, if you will, but the actions that they actually are doing are very much immoral to a large degree. And so if you think about this throughout the history of the United States, I wouldn't say it's an escalation of immorality, because I would also argue that there has been this immoral code that's persisted within the history of our country, dating all the way back to slavery or beyond slavery for that matter. And so it's these issues that I would say has persisted over time that we see has escalated to a large degree to what we see in 2015, right? And so I would argue that if we can somehow shift the moral character, if you will, of this country, I think we can see somewhat a de-escalation of these things that are happening. But that's going to take a lot of work, and that's going to take a lot of self-work. And so you have to ask the question, I mean, when we talk about what is that we can do, we have to check ourselves, first and foremost, when it's all said and done. But more importantly, for those folks who are going to law enforcement, we have to check our biases as well. Just the same way as our biases can transform into a college classroom, the same way happens in any other occupation, for that matter. And I would say just as damaging as it is in terms of the militarization of the police, we also think about these things within the classroom settings, because all of us do have biases, right? And so how do we check these biases in a fashion as to where it's not impeding or causing harm, if you will? And so I would argue that the fundamental piece of this idea of militarization of police is this issue of moral character or moral or immorality, if you will. Because, again, we've seen these things happen way too often within our society. And I would argue that it will only get worse, because with this escalation of the military, with the escalation of the police force, with the escalation of this arms force, arms race, if you will, and this idea that somehow what a black body or brown body represents, it's not changing. And so we have to really start to think about what is it that we can do for ourselves, that self-work, if you will, especially for those folks who are going into law enforcement. But more specifically, and we're talking about those folks who are in law enforcement already or currently in law enforcement, how do we help change the mindsets and the hearts of these people, right? Because when it's all said and done, you have to ask yourself the question, what is life worth? What is a life worth? And at the end of the day, if you think that you can pull out a gun and kill somebody at will, then that gives you that answer, how much life is truly worth. Because if, I don't know if anybody will actually attest to this, but if anybody has anybody killed anybody in here, I mean, you don't have to raise your hand, because I don't want to know, to be honest with you. But I can only imagine the difficulty it is to a person with the same mind or some sense of moral character, how difficult it would be to take somebody else's life. That's a very hard thing to do, right? But to suggest that somebody could just come up and snuff off somebody else's life, that's hard. And so what that means is that for that person who's taking that other person's life, I mean, this is the kind of the psychology behind war, right? We dehumanize people, right, to a large degree. That way they're not human in our eyes. So it makes it much easier to take somebody's life. And this is the whole escalation of militarization of police as well, right? So we see the same thing happen on our streets. There, some folks are being dehumanized, and so they're not human. And so we can hear the narratives of, the officer, and Ferguson, how he was describing how he was describing Mike Brown. I mean, very beastly, he was like the Hulk. So these are all characteristics of somebody being dehumanized. So in his eyes, in that instance, I would say that he wasn't human. So it was much easier for him to just take all this gun and take his life. So let's ask the question, what is the value of life? And if we can't honestly answer that question, say that every life is valuable, irrespective of what walk of life you come from, what ailments you may have, then we have a lot of work to do. So getting back to this issue of moral character, or how do we build up the moral character of this of these United States?
Thank you, Dr. Land, and I must say you still do a good job with monologues. We're going to turn over the questions to the audience, but I'll start out to warm you up, and as you think about what you'd like to ask, Preston is going to go around the room with the mic, and you can ask a short question so our panelists can have opportunity to respond. Let me start with Professor Chang. I was disturbed to hear you talk about these students in Atlanta and how they were searched. What kind of psychological effect would that have on these school children and even in their interest in wanting to be in school? How committed can I be to an unwelcoming environment when I have to go through searches like that?
That's absolutely right. So I use the Atlanta School District story because the facts are so immediately compelling. And what's interesting to note was it wasn't a regular public school. It was a disciplinary alternative school. And I think to tie this back to something Roderick was talking about, we dehumanize our school children too, right? The idea is some kids are just bad kids, and we need to keep the good kids safe from the bad kids, and so we isolate them, we segregate them, if you will, into this disciplinary alternative school, which, incidentally, was 100% black. Totally a terrible place. And so, obviously, those children were, I met with many of them, they were my name plaintiffs, my clients. A lot of them were just hugely disheartened by all of this, right? I mean, they were essentially checked out. A lot of them had parents who were really frustrated with the system, were trying to get them into a better school, a different school, but the system gives you the runaround. And the kids were, they started to act out even more. The response was often, well, you know what, you think I'm a terrible kid, I'll show you just how bad I can be, right? But I use that as an example. It's an extreme example, but things similar to that are happening right in our own backyards. And this is something we often don't want to confront in Utah. We think, oh, everyone gets along here. We're all so nice. And it's why I like the Johns Hopkins study that says if you're disciplined even once in the ninth grade, you're already 3.5 times more likely to drop out, right? So, the kids at this school in Atlanta were all but lost. I mean, it was almost impossible to get them back onto the education track. Even parents who devoted superhuman efforts, there were just heartbreaking stories of what happened to these children afterwards. But here, there's still hope. And I think, if we fight against it, we rage against the machine, we can get something done still here.
Great. Are there any questions in the audience? We have one in the back.
Just as a quick reminder, please introduce yourself and maybe state your major before we ask your question.
My name is Olo Matoa. My major is Health, Society, and Policy. And this is for you, gentlemen on the farthest left. As far as housing, education, and recreation goes, focusing on housing, how do you actually bring about tangible change? Is it sustainability, affordability, or opportunity?
That's a good question, and it's a little bit outside of my wheelhouse, to be honest with you, but I will say that we know historically there have been a number of processes which have redlining by real estates, by mortgage lenders, that sort of thing, which have created segregation. And it's a difficult problem because what's happened now in cities like Chicago and Detroit is you have very, distinctly defined communities of not just of people of color, but of ethnic, European ethnics, and Greeks, for example, in Detroit. And a lot of whites have fled. If you look at a city like Detroit, many whites have moved out to communities like Royal Oaks and Livonia and places like that. There is no easy solution to that problem. And again, I would say that the primary problem now is probably economic inequality. The reason people can't move out to areas that are more, and many African Americans who can't afford to have, but there are many, many individuals who are still trapped in a cycle of poverty that makes it effectively impossible for them to break out. We need jobs that will give people good wages, and a whole host of other remedies for economic inequality that ultimately is at the root of that.
Also say, if you're interested, the ACLU has a pending lawsuit against J.P. Morgan, I think that's the main defendant, about its predatory lending and redlining practices, which grossly disproportionately affected poor people of color.
Professor Holmes, I'd like for you to extend your initial comment based on Professor Chang's response about the Atlanta school children. And how does that feed into today's prison industrial complex?
Well, you're asking me the tough ones. It is the case that, you know, really there are a number of, if you will, pipelines starting in schools for particularly young African-American males to find their way to the penitentiary. As you said, individuals who are disciplined, and it's a miracle I graduated from high school thinking about that, who are disciplined have a much higher rate of dropping out. And, of course, these are likely to be young black men. And as they drop out, what are the opportunities available to them? What are they going to do with their lives? Well, frequently, because of the lack of opportunities, the lack of jobs available to anyone now who has less than a high school education, they're going to find themselves oftentimes out of work and on the streets and under the eyes of the police. And the police actively work African-American neighborhoods, disadvantaged neighborhoods for drug sweeps, that sort of thing, which brings people into the pipeline. And so it's almost impossible for many young men in disadvantaged neighborhoods to avoid being arrested. The police assume that you are a potential problem simply by virtue of the fact that you live in that neighborhood. And I don't know if that really gets at what you're asking, but I think that as I see it, it's almost a conveyor belt, if you will, where when people come into contact with the police, more affluent individuals, particularly whites, are likely to drop off that conveyor belt. They may not be arrested, or if they are, they may be sent into some kind of diversion program and so on, where the young African-American male is likely to wind up in the penitentiary. And the reason we've had such a huge growth, as Michelle Alexander points out in her works, in the penitentiary system in the last 30 years is because of the war on drugs. Most of the individuals who find their way to the penitentiary today do not represent a significant threat to society. We are conducting a war against them because of the fact that we perceive drugs to be a menace. Whether or not they are, I can't say. I don't think there's a real problem in Colorado right now.
But any other questions? Yes. Can you wait for the mic, please?
Hi, my name's Sarah Wheatley, and I'm a political science major. This question is for Emily. I just wanted to see if you could talk about the relationship between militarization and citizens carrying firearms, and, you know, some could argue citizens carrying firearms promotes police brutality or militarization. Which comes first?
Yeah, that's interesting. So, you know, obviously there's this whole debate about gun control, which I've heard advocates have recently rebranded gun safety, which I think is probably a good rebranding move. Much like, you know, it's not gay marriage anymore, it's marriage equality, right? So, you know, I think that there's, you know, again, this comes to, and I think Roderick talked a little bit about this as well, you know, our culture. And I think that Americans are often kind of oblivious to the idea that there is a culture because we see it as like, well, this is it, right? We can be sort of provincial that way. But I think there is a culture of, you know, independence, authority issues. The gun debate, I think, absolutely reflects that. What the cause and effect is of people wanting to arm themselves, you know, versus the militarization, I think it's the those two things tend to fall on the same side of the spectrum rather than on opposite sides of the spectrum. But a lot of it is fear, right? It's fear of the unknown, fear of the other. And the idea is there are all of these dangerous people out there, the other, these people who live in these unsafe neighborhoods, these people who we don't go to the same church, we don't eat at the same restaurants, you know, because we went to different schools and we live in different neighborhoods, right? And the idea is the cops feel like they need to be armed against them. And then, you know, I think the reaction in the public is often very unfortunate sometimes where, you know, you read about this stuff happening and instead of thinking like, wow, that's really, you know, maybe the police need better communication techniques, we think, I need to get a gun too, right? And so I think the only thing we can do or hope for really is the only way out is some sort of national conversation. I think the one good thing that has come out of Ferguson, and I hope it continues, is, you know, for the first time, I'm seeing a sort of sustained national conversation. You know, it's happening in sort of fits and starts, and I don't know that the link to gun control or gun safety has been made explicitly, but we're at least starting to talk about these things, and that's the only way we're going to get ourselves out of it.
Okay. Before we go to you, let me ask Dr. Lana a question. You talked about this kind of dehumanization that you must have, and I took my family to see Selma last night, and I think it was a pretty good opening chapter for us to have discussions to carry on into the community, into classrooms. But knowing history and seeing images come to mind like the lynchings in East St. Louis, where whites were around burnt bodies that had been lynched and shot, fingers removed, toes removed, smiling. Children smiling. White men and white women smiling. Whites in the audience at the movie last night gasping when they see billy clubs being hit over the head of black women and black men. We have a lot of focus that tends to be aimed at communities of color about their transformation. You having a background in psychology and counseling, what should we do with white psychology and transformation? Where should the focus be on that aspect?
Do you want to take this question?
All I can say with that is good luck. When you look at what's happening in America right now with cases like Brown and Garner and New York, there's a tremendous divide between whites and blacks in how they perceive that these events and whether or not they're police brutality. But I'll let you answer.
Let me answer this question in two parts, right? First, in the sense that I don't want to generalize all whites to be the same, first and foremost. Because I would even suggest that even during the 1930s, when you had a heavy dose of lynching that was taking place in the country, you still had white folks who were not doing the lynching as well. And the same thing in terms of looking at the civil rights movement, you did have some white folks who were very much participatory in the civil rights movement. So when you talk about this transformation of whites as relates to this idea of dehumanization, I would also argue that, I would suggest that that transformation takes place from within, right? But there has to be this continuous conversation or pressure that's placed upon the broader community, if you will, to talk about lives matter, period, irrespective of what race, color, creed that you are. And so I would argue that in order for that transformation to take place, they want to have to make that change, if you will. And I would say that we can definitely do our own due diligence in terms of providing that information, providing the context or the platform for that to happen. But it's hard work. And so anytime you talk about change, a fundamental change to a person's psychology or moral character, it's a lonely space. And I would argue that a lot of times people don't want to be in that space, right, because it is difficult. And so when you start thinking about these transformational changes, I mean, it really talks about this idea that you're admitting that you're wrong. And so how many of us want to admit that we're wrong? And until we can come to grips with this idea that somehow what we've done historically or what we're currently doing is not right and we have to make that shift, then it's not going to happen. And so that transformation, again, I would say has to come from within.
Okay. Yes.
Hi. My name is Shayla Archer, and I'm a communications major, poli-sci minor. My question is for Professor Chang. What do you see as the institution that needs to reform policy in schools to help that the ninth grade statistic. Do you think it's like a or more of a federal policy change, or is it more like school by school, county by county?
So it's, you know, one of the issues that we've had in this work is, you know, no one individual person can fix this, right? You can vow as an individual teacher, okay, I'm going to think twice before disciplining a kid, or I'm going to take the unbiased, unconscious bias test and see, you know, do I have some issues that I need to be more aware of, right? But that's not going to be enough. You can have individual schools implement pilot programs. Some schools in Utah have. Individual school districts have. Canyon School District, for example, recently implemented some changes. I think it has to be on a state-by-state level, mostly because education is so state-based. You know, the federal government urges, it harangues, you know, it issues guidances, it collects data, and that's all important. But at the end of the day, you know, the state needs to decide, okay, we have to do something. Unfortunately, I think with problems like this, you know, there's a lot of defensiveness and then a lot of finger-pointing, right? The legislators say, well, really, you should talk to the school superintendent. And then the teachers say, you know, this isn't our fault. We're doing the best that we can. So it's one of those diffuse problems of, you know, sort of like mass incarceration, where it's no one individual decision. It's the amalgamation of so many individual decisions. And so part of what I see my role as is raising awareness. That, you know, if I can get a bunch of teachers to stop and think or to go along with some discipline policy changes in their school to at least support the effort, if we can get the ear of some education policymakers to say, okay, you know, maybe we need to revise our policies. LA School District, for example, recently got rid of all school discipline for the offense of insubordination, which is like this totally vague idea, right? What typically happens was the teacher says, sit down, and the kid says, uh-uh. Right? And it's like, that's it. You're out, right? Go to the principal's office. And it was, of course, disproportionately children of color, more often boys than girls. And so, you know, a lot of it, I think, does have to come at the school district and the state level.
Okay. Meg, we have plenty of examples of movements coming from young folk. And we also have many examples of social movement coming from the creative arts. What's the pulse, in your sense, of the creative art movement in this whole conversation?
I think it's a difficult question for me to answer because I'm very much in the middle of it. For me to take the pulse of the creative arts movement in response to the militarization of policing, but especially in regards to Ferguson right now, is entirely poet-based. I don't know how many emails I get a day that's just, you know, different folks for the arts organizing and mobilizing. We've set a number of buses full of folks to Ferguson in the last 5 months, just full of poets, which I don't... How weird does that sound? It doesn't sound strange to me at all. And then I leave my home, and here you are. I do think that the creative movement is going to be integral, or already is, and has proven itself historically in the question of humanization, in the question of a national conversation in terms of archiving from first-person perspectives what's happening in terms of mass incarceration, in terms of what's happening at the high school level. Before moving to Utah, that's pretty much all I did was work with young folks in high schools to get them to write enough poems to make them want to stay in school. Hmm. I think that it's an access point for everybody in this room. I think it's an access point that's being systematically sort of jolted out of school systems because of the lack of funding for the arts, which is a whole different conversation. But I do think that they intersect very early on in the conversation of education and in terms of access. And more often than not, I think that the creative movement is at once most important and also most affecting in communities that are historically disadvantaged and marginalized, including folks of color, including the queer community, including the disability rights sort of movement and community around that. So I do think that it's easy to overlook, and also that's fine. It's going to happen anyway.
Thank you. I thought I saw the mic right there.
This question is for Professor Lang.
State your name.
Okay. My name's Adrian. I'm a social work gender studies double major. And I had a question for you. You spoke about how you believe that a lot of police brutality and police militarization is rooted in morality and how police officers become the judge of morality of their citizens. Do you believe that the disproportionate amount of violence towards Black Americans is rooted in dehumanization that can be traced back to the institution of slavery and can still be seen today in, like, representation in the media and other things like that?
And can you answer that in 1 minute?
I can answer in 1 second. Yes. Absolutely. Yes. I think that's just a part of the psyche of America in terms of how we perceive Black bodies when it's all said and done. And so if you think about how America was, let me rephrase that, how some parts of America was introduced to Black bodies was in the context of slavery. And so understand the fact that who our first teachers are our parents and how this gets passed down from generation to generation to generation, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's one of those things where even if you think about this idea from slavery to 2015 with Ferguson, I mean, it is about this idea of a dehumanized body, if you will, and there's no more than just property or just an animal. If you will.
Okay. I think I saw Associate Vice President's hand up first.
Hi, Catherine Stockton, interim AVP for Equity and Diversity and English professor. So I want to come back to this point about discourse. I think such important things have been said about policy, which I totally value. That's so important. And I want to try to link Meg's comment to Roderick's. One thing that I have learned about my own white privilege is I suffer from politeness. I suffer from manners. And I don't know if anybody else in this room watches Downton Abbey. I watch it for research purposes. But they ran a whole segment last week after Downton Abbey about manners. And it is such a scathing indictment of the history of manners. If you think about where manners come from or where politeness comes from, it comes from control, it comes from hierarchy, it comes from ownership. And I think one of the problems we're going to have to solve is to figure out how to have new ways of speaking about respect that don't fall into the bin of politeness or manners. And I think we're in a local culture that values politeness. Again, I do too. I'm copying to my sort of love of manners and politeness. But I think that's going to be one of the discursive problems to solve in our movements, to speak on many different registers and to find ways of thinking about respect and dignity, but also ways of embracing creative shame, making things of our history of shame, which I think certain groups have been expert out, queers and people of color and women have had to make things of shame. So that's what I'm learning about my own white privilege. I'm trying to solve the problem of my own politeness and push it into a different place and realize that sometimes morality, particularly I think when white folks talk about morality, it's a cover for dodging politics, and we cannot allow morality to conquer the ground of politics. So just a thought for me today.
All right. Thank you. We have 1 minute before our radio broadcast ends. So is there a panelist that would like to sum it up? Or I saw Dr. White's hand. As a psychologist, do you want to take a shot at summarizing this? Dr. White?
Well, one of the things I was going to ask... And
in 1 minute, by the way.
One of the things I was thinking about and was going to ask is, how do we talk about this, reach this beyond the people in the room, beyond the people who are listening, to get into real discourse, real dialogue on issues of inequality, morality, thinking of difference, to have people talking about this issue beyond just a particular instance, that there's got to be more to it than just this one time. How do we sustain this ongoing?
In 15 seconds, somebody, anybody.
I would say that the events of the last few months with the protests that have been taking place in Ferguson and New York City is a way of starting a dialogue. It's civil disorder, but civil disorder is something that is essential to social change. And without that kind of dialogue, and not polite. It's not a dialogue of manners. People are not going to be aware. And our time is about out. But I will say that, it behooves the young people in here.
We got to wrap it up. So I just want to thank you. I want to thank everybody for coming out and hearing our panelists discuss this. But stick around. We'll ask more questions, and they'll have more answers for you. Thank you.